A podcast of the cinema, starring me. My name is Dave White. I'm a film critic from nowhere, from nobody.
Came from nowhere and became a star.
You are Alonzo Duralde. Yes. You're somebody. Man. You are a film critic, and you are the film reviews editor at The Wrap. You're the co-host of many other podcasts.
Yes.
I don't even know how many you're on now. You start a new one this week. Your whole life is like,
yeah.
I don't listen to any of them, by the way.
That's, didn't think you did.
Because that's too much. Too much you in my ears, in my eyes, all day, every day.
There's been a lot of togetherness.
Pandemic togetherness.
Over this.
11 months of you. You know what, though? It's pretty good. You're very entertaining and a pleasure to be with.
I try.
Unless you're really bothering me, and then I'm like, go to your room.
Sometimes I'm like, I love our wonderful sized apartment. Sometimes I think, I'm trapped in this box with him.
This is our first podcast post hideous Trump administration.
Is it?
Yeah. Last week was the inauguration of Joe Biden, the new president.
Oh, gosh, you're right. This is our first show.
This is our first show after the exit of the terrible one.
Yeah.
Next, I'm hoping he drops dead.
Oh, I want a full trial in the Senate.
Sure. And then I want him found guilty, and then I want him to drop dead. And I know listeners are like, how dare you say these sorts of things? And I'm like, who cares?
I want him to watch his world fall apart.
You're right.
I want him to be stripped.
Right. There should be suffering.
I want him to be stripped of wealth. Of power, of whatever grubby prestige he thinks he has.
We're vindictive.
Yeah.
This is a vindictive podcast. We don't seek justice so much as revenge.
Pretty much.
And so, but only for him.
Yeah.
Like everyone else gets sort of like, you know, understanding and forgiveness.
Well,
most everyone else.
He's got his inner circle, you know.
Oh, no, I wasn't talking about, I was talking about people in our life.
Oh, sure. Yeah, they get the benefit of the doubt. Betsy DeVos, on the other hand, doesn't.
Right, she's not in our life. Do you know, I'm a friend who said this was not for air, so I won't say who it was.
Okay.
Said, how come you didn't talk about Michelle Obama's outfit? And I said, I didn't see it. And he was like, how did you not see her outfit? I said, I took Twitter off my phone 2 weeks ago before the inauguration, not because of the inauguration, just because I thought, you know what? I'm taking Twitter off my phone. I kept my Twitter account, but it's only accessed on my laptop now, which means I spend about 15 minutes a day on Twitter. And that's it. So I've missed so much. And I missed her outfit. Then he sent me pictures of her outfit. And I was like, oh no, I need to put Twitter back on my phone. Because.
For the outfit.
Did you see the outfit?
I did see the outfit.
Wow.
That was great.
Wow.
It was great. A lot of
wow.
A lot of impressive sartorial choices. Does she unseat Amanda Gorman as my queen for the day? No.
I don't know.
An impressive showing.
In terms of outfits, it's a the toss-up. Outfit included. It's a toss-up.
That was
two good outfits.
Yes. I'm not here to make, you know, to pit women against each other. They looked great.
The I wore pajamas. Well, but I was here in the house.
Yes.
And it was raining.
Yes. You were not in attendance.
And no one asked me to go anywhere.
No.
I wasn't invited to the inauguration.
If you had gone to the inauguration, we would have had the Bernie meme and the Dave White meme.
What? No. I would have looked delightful. I would have dressed nicely. I would have worn, you know, my nice Brooks Brothers suit.
Yeah, under a heavy coat.
And under
would,
a big...
And you would sit there looking grim. I would have had...
No.
Under a mask.
That is, I would have... My mask would have been on.
Yes.
And I would have had an overcoat because just apparently everyone is given one in Washington, D.C. All the people at inaugurations are given these long woolen overcoats.
It's January.
And I'm like, oh, everyone just has those.
They're not skiing.
I live in Los Angeles.
They're wearing coats that go over a suit.
I have a need for one of those. I've never been a banker in New York, so I don't have one for there either.
As much as I love Los Angeles, every time it's like hat and scarf and mitten season, a part of me dies. I'll just say it.
Bernie Sanders is his own beautiful creation.
Yes,
and
his own stylist.
I would have looked, more put together. But then again, you know, I'll never be the socialist that he is.
You would have been.
I'll try. I try really hard.
Yes. 2 hours on a plastic chair, you'd have that same look on your face.
Oh, plastic chair. I would be up in about 5 minutes because my entire body would be racked with pain.
Yes.
But that's my problem. Bernie Sanders is clearly a fit man who can sit in a plastic chair for a long time. I'm a fat man who cannot sit in a plastic chair for a long time. Or I break the chair, or the chair breaks me.
These are the options.
Those are the only options. what day is it? It's Monday.
It is Monday.
We didn't do this yesterday because you were on a long business call regarding the Sundance Film Festival.
Yes, which you're starts going to be, Thursday.
You're going to be covering it
from
this apartment.
That's how everyone is covering the Sundance Film Festival.
I find this fascinating. And aren't there going to be a lot of, like, Zoom events?
Oh, yeah. It is all virtual. Like, people are not gathering in Park City in any way. So the Q&As are going to be virtual. The intros, I think, have been like pre-recorded.
Right.
There's going to be like these sort of like virtual kind of party spaces where like you're going to have an avatar with your face on it. And you'll be like,
is it going to be like a video game where you move your avatar around a screen?
I guess. I don't know.
Do you like do little dances? Will there be DJs?
There will be karaoke, apparently.
What?
I'm sure this is like...
Where's Jen Yamato?
I was going to say, I'm sure this is all to accommodate Jen Yamato's Sundance experience. Jen Yamato and Matt Singer insisted there had to be karaoke going on. Yeah, I don't know. It's all talk so far. I'll let you know once we're in there and I'll show you.
Are you going to do karaoke?
Depends on how late. I don't know. That's I'll tell you. Here's
I believe the children of the future. Teach them well and let them lead the way.
People who go to Sundance and who like party and socialize and do all that stuff at night, more power to them. I got to be in bed early.
Yeah, you do.
Because those first screenings start at like 9 a.m. and you got to go line up and do all that stuff.
Wait.
Not
you mean the real Sundance?
The real Sundance.
Okay.
Yeah, not the virtual.
Right.
Also, I cannot have any alcohol at that altitude or I will die. I have to be drinking like triple amounts of water just to like maintain and stay even.
You are already so full of water. You're like one of those small town Texas tanks that are like high up in the air.
Yeah, seriously, Sundance, like I basically am never not drinking water at
right.
Sundance because I'm just it's sponging the life out of me
right.
being in the mountains like that.
Huh. Well, it won't be like that this year, though.
It will not.
So you can do karaoke.
Again, depending on what time.
Do you need me to join you for a duet of Nothing Compares to You? I've done that.
It's been 7 hours.
You just heard me sing a little bit of a song, and you know that I do not sound like that, whatever that was.
Okay, sure.
I'm smooth with singing. Can also carry a tune-ish. Mm. Kind of. Good enough.
You're a veritable, what's the R&B singer whose last name is Guy?
What?
Who am I thinking of?
Jasmine Guy?
Not Jasmine Guy. There's a there's a dude who has
she had a brief recording career.
She did. I know. But that's not who I'm thinking of.
Some New Jack Swing niceness.
It's flown out of my head now. She was in School Days.
Jasmine Guy was.
Yeah.
Yes, I know this.
Yeah. So she's one of the
last name was Guy, an R&B singer whose last name was
maybe,
Guy.
Maybe I'm remembering this wrong. Never mind. The whole joke makes no sense. Never mind.
Would you like to talk about a film instead?
Let's do that.
All right. The Marksman ain't good. Why don't you talk about it?
Okay. All right. Well, it's Liam Neeson, and Liam Neeson is armed and grumpy.
He's killing people.
Liam Neeson is a rancher on the Arizona border. He is a Vietnam vet, despite the fact that he talks like Liam Neeson.
Right.
The little-known Irish brigades of the U.S. Army during that conflict.
There may have been a pocket. You don't know.
This is true. Who's to say? Anyway, so, so his ranch butts right up against, the wall, and he keeps a walkie-talkie to be in touch with the Border Patrol, which his stepdaughter is sort of running the local version of.
Here's my question.
Uh-huh.
They never explain why he has the walkie-talkie to talk to Border Patrol.
Yeah, they do.
They did?
Because he's it's a thing that comes up a lot.
But he doesn't work for the Border Patrol.
No, but his stepdaughter does.
So he's just a vigilante.
He's
to report on people crossing the border.
He's more a snitch. If he were a vigilante, he would be like pulling guns on people. Instead, he just tells his stepdaughter, hey, I just saw like four people run through the blah, 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 blah.
Okay, so yes, we established that he is terrible.
Yes.
Go on.
So then one day, a woman and her young child come through, and they are chased by members of the cartel.
Oh, the cartel?
The cartel. Okay.
Yeah.
The cartel.
Right.
And Neeson at first reports them, but then there's a bit of a skirmish with the cartel guys, and Neeson tries to defend them, but the mother gets shot, and in her dying moments...
Mind you, he says to them, I'm going to call Border Patrol. They'll help you. He literally says this, and I'm like, I'm sorry, who's the president?
Yeah.
Like... No, they're not going to help her. No. They're going to kidnap her child from her.
Yes.
Go home, old man. Shut up. Turn off. Someone get that walkie-talkie out of his hand and smash it to pieces.
Anyway, dying woman extracts a promise from him to take the child to Chicago where they have relatives.
Right.
He does. After springing the child from a detention center with barely a how do you do.
Yeah, like, yeah. Oh.
Just it's, waltzes it's in, waltzes
magnificently
out.
Magnificently easy to do this.
Yeah.
So I guess you guys, you've been going about it wrong this whole time. You've just been protesting.
Yeah.
When you just should have been going
walk
to
out of the cages.
Just spring people.
Sure.
Like it's that fast and that smooth.
So grumpy old dude and, bereaved but spunky child are making their way cross country with bad guys in SUV in tow. And of course, like all these various cops and whatnot along the way are in on it.
They're in on it. Yeah. They're working with
The cartel.
The cartel. Yeah. And Liam Neeson kills a bunch of people.
Yeah. And look, I like a Liam Neeson kills a bunch of people when it's done well.
As do I.
There are several I think are very entertaining.
Completely true.
I particularly enjoy his collaborations with I think he's Catalan filmmaker, Jean-Michelet Seurat.
Uh-huh.
Who gave us Unknown.
That's cool.
Which is Liam Neeson bumps his head and doesn't remember that he's a killer.
Right.
Nonstop. Liam Neeson is on a plane and may or may not be the killer.
Right.
And The Commuter. Liam Neeson needs to find the killer on a subway train.
Yep.
And the one
solid entertainment
and Run All Night, where Liam Neeson is Liam Neeson is a drunk in the Boston mob who has to get his act together and kill some people.
I forget that one.
I think like John, not John. I think Ed Harris might be in that one.
Listen, unless it's got wolves in it, they all blur together.
Gotcha. Anyway.
All right.
This is not nearly as interesting as the good Liam Neeson shoots a bunch of people movies. It is directed by a guy named Robert Lorenz, who I believe maybe also co-wrote. And
he has exclusively, or would you like to say this? Would you like to announce this?
Almost entirely, the career of Robert Lorenz has been in the service of one Clint Eastwood. Mm-hmm. He actually directed Trouble with the Curve, but beyond that, he has like produced or had something or other to do with like Clint for quite a while now.
So this has Clint Eastwood's coffee stains on the cover of the strip.
Totally. This totally feels like Clint in like The Mule and Gran Torino mode, where he's like,
I'm a crusty old quasi-racist person, or completely racist
exactly.
person.
Exactly. But not beyond learning something when personal circumstances force me.
Valiantly saving any number of people of color.
Exactly.
Because that's...
The white man's a bird.
What white thing is...
Yeah.
Yeah. What's the white thing that happens in this movie? It's Clint Eastwood. What's the white thing that happens in this movie? It's Liam Neeson.
And not that this movie would have been any better if Clint had said yes to it, but...
No. Nothing could make this better.
No. It's not...
Because it's...
It's not good.
It's... Not only is it a laughably goofy movie, but it's racist. This movie's racist.
Yeah, the main bad guy from The Cartel.
Yeah.
They try at the last minute, they sprinkle these things in along the way. Like, we're gonna make him a real character,
right?
And we're gonna make like it's gonna ultimately come down to this, like he and Liam Neeson are battling for the kid's soul or whatever.
Yeah.
But it's so just sort of ham-fisted, where like the bad guy sees like a dad and his son playing catch in a park and broods about it,
right.
And you can tell his life has been stolen away by the cartel,
right.
And but it's like, no, you did not bolster this particular subplot enough to make this guy not just a two-dimensional bad guy from the cartel,
right? If you are a fan of Liam Neeson kills a bunch of people movies, just go watch a different one.
Yeah, I mean, Honest Thief is better than this one, and it was sort of whatever.
And that was like...
Not that long ago.
2 weeks ago that came out.
Yeah.
When was that?
Late 2020.
Early, yeah. Like, there's too much.
Yeah.
Too much Liam Neeson.
He's making too many ones for them and not enough one for me.
Like, what would a one for him look like?
Well, okay. Did you see the movie that he did with Leslie Manville where she has cancer?
No, I missed that one, and I hear it was good.
It is good.
Yeah.
I'm forgetting the name of it. But that is totally a one for him.
Yeah.
That's a movie that recalls on him to be a genuine actor, and he can't... Ordinary Love. He can be a really good actor when he feels like it.
Oh, I know.
Like
back in the day, 80s and 90s, he was, one of those A-list serious guys.
Yeah. Rob Roy.
Right.
That dumb movie with Justine Bateman. Satisfaction.
Hey, now.
Bad example.
Don't listen. Don't talk trash about Satisfaction. I won't have it.
I do think Liam Neeson wears a bathing suit in that movie, so there is that.
Sure. I mean, you know.
And I think like he...
The legend and all.
I think he and Julia Roberts had like a brief fling from that movie.
Oh, did they?
Yeah.
Okay.
This was like... Sure. This is early Julia.
Right. Yeah, it was.
Pre-Pretty Woman. Post-Mystic Pizza.
Let's dispense with the marksman. He's a very good marksman, by the way. That's why they call it
the
marksman.
Yes.
Don't mess with the marksman.
He'll
shoot you. Yeah.
Yes.
All right. Let's kick into an ad.
Okay.
I have one for you.
Great.
Amber Petty just never gives it a rest. She keeps on advertising on this podcast.
And bless her for it.
Are you you a freelance writer? Big mistake.
No.
But anyway, if you want to be one, you should take Amber Petty's 8-week freelance writing class.
Yes.
This class covers all the basics. What kind of articles do editors want? How do you pitch? How do I stop my brain from saying no one cares about my ideas? With video modules, helpful downloads, and live Q&As, you will get the accountability you need to get started and get your writing out there. By the end of 8 weeks, you'll have 6 completed articles.
Wow.
I can't complete one in 8 weeks. 6 pitches?
Maybe you should take the class.
I don't have 6 pitches in a year. Actually, I never pitch anybody anything.
Kids, don't be like Dave White. Take Amber's class and learn how to actually get this job and do it right.
And you can sell a story before class is over.
Wow.
In Amber's last class, every student who sent a pitch sold a pitch.
Woo. Well then.
I don't think you can argue with that. I don't sort think of you can. Like statistic there.
That's some efficacy right
and
there.
And some of them had no previously published samples.
Cool.
One student made $500 from her writing within the first month. Of course, there's no guarantee your pitches will get picked up, but even in these miserable pandemic times, it's happened to many of her students. The class begins February 1st. Today is the 25th. You don't have much time. Get in there. Give her your money.
Make it happen.
Be in the class. As a special Linoleum Knife listener, you get $50 off.
Sweet.
To sign up.
We never did anything for you.
To sign up, go to amberpetty.com, A-M-B-E-R, P-E-T-T-Y, like Tom Petty, amberpetty.com/enroll. Use the code word linoleum at checkout for $50 off.
That's a sweet deal.
It is a sweet deal, because apparently you're going to make some money freelance writing.
Mm-hmm.
I should take this class.
Perhaps you should.
I have no idea what I'm doing with my life anymore. Next movie.
Yes.
Talk about another movie. Promising Young Woman.
Yes.
What a controversy about this film. Mm. For so long now. Wasn't it at Sundance like last year?
It was at Sundance last year.
And it has, from that moment until now, garnered the kind of reaction that is like, you love it or you hate it.
Yeah.
It's sort of like not... No, very few people are walking away from this going, yeah, it's fine, whatever, sure, I guess it was okay.
It does not prompt that kind of response.
I will not name names, but a friend of mine, ours, who is having a divorce, texted me and said, I watched it twice this past weekend. I bought the soundtrack.
Okay.
I was like, I understand. I totally understand why. It's the first film by Emerald Fennell.
I think it's Fennell.
Is it Fennell?
I think it's Fennell.
I just like fennel so much.
Fennel's
as a food
delicious.
That I just think, you know,
I think it's spelled
if you had that last name, you would want to say
celery. Dave Celery Roots. Dave White Asparagus.
Anyway, Emerald Fennell. We'll call her Fennell.
Yes.
She plays Camilla Parker Bowles on The Crown, or
yes.
She did anyway.
And she was on, I think, Get the Midwife? Call the Midwife.
Get that Midwife! catch that Midwife!
And Christy Love. Call the Midwife.
Yeah, so she acts, and now she has written and directed a feature.
Yes.
It stars Carey Mulligan as a young woman who is an avenging angel. She is on a mission of real-time vengeance.
Yes.
And at first, we don't quite know what, why.
Right.
But what we do know is that she goes to bars, sort of happy hour situations. Mm-hmm. Business dudes are all hanging out. And she pretends to be blackout drunk. She waits for one guy to come. Hey, can I give you a ride home?
Are you okay?
Are you okay? Let's take care of you. And then immediately the guy's like, hey, we're going to my place. And then, you know, the gotcha moment happens.
Yeah.
They're at his place. She is not drunk at all. She is waiting for him to try to be bad. And she says, hey, guess what? I'm not drunk. What are we going to do about that? And often what takes place after that moment is not seen on camera.
Mm-hmm.
You see her like strutting out of the situation.
She marks it in a book and she uses different color ink, which I suppose is to imply that
something
there are differing outcomes of this?
Either differing outcomes or differing reasons, and the movie doesn't explain why.
Right.
Yeah. Okay. So
I'll say this though, since you've already at this point of the movie, that's in the trailer. That whole setup and thing.
Yes.
And so, of course, my immediate thought, after a steady diet of, you know, Ms. 45 and right. Hothead Paisan, is like, she kills them.
Hothead Paisan has shaped my entire Lady Vengeance, understanding of the world. If you don't know what Hothead Paisan was, Diane DeMassa, comic book artist, in the 90s, when we were young and queer nationing and ACT UPing, you and me, we met at an ACT UP demonstration, by the way.
It's true.
So this romance has roots. All right. Anyway, she had a comic book called Hothead Paisan, Homicidal Lesbian Terrorist. Hothead Paisan, for no real reason other than why not, ran around mutilating men and collecting their parts like a psychopath. And yet, you were on her side.
She was the hero.
She was the hero. You cheered her on. And so I, too, when I saw the trailer for this film, I thought, oh, Carey Mulligan's going to go around murdering people. No. Now, I don't want to give away plot stuff.
Okay, we can be cagey.
But I can tell you this, I think, very safely.
Mm-hmm.
We learn that she is avenging the gang rape of a college friend.
Med school.
It's college, right?
Grad school.
Grad school. Medical school.
Yes.
They were in medical school. And she has picked people out of this scenario to hunt. And one by one, she confronts them. And she does so in a way that is effective for her purposes. And also begins to feel like a series of symbolic targets.
Mm-hmm.
I won't tell you how it ends because that's where people are really getting, disagreement-y about the film. I will say this regarding, the filmmaking. I like quite a bit of the filmmaking here.
Uh-huh.
Because it is absolutely a heightened reality.
Mm-hmm.
There is nothing really plausible going on. Because everything from her setup to the people she encounters along the way, they don't feel like real human interactions. They feel like symbols. And she's knocking down symbols one by one over the course of the film. And once she's done it a couple times, you think, okay, I get what's going on. I see how this is happening. She's framed in two main ways, in like lurid sort of like bloody club lighting, or in the daylight hours, in situations where there's so much pastel pink and blue surrounding her. And I mean, you know, the genderiest of colors.
Mm-hmm. But everything that's happening is still supposed to be realistic.
It's her real life, but it's not real life.
I understand that. I'm saying, like, I think there's a distinction between...
This isn't a fantasy, yes, is what I'm saying.
Yes.
And I think that's what you're trying to communicate.
Yes, that
as
it's
well.
Couched visually in a very heightened sense of things, but at the same time, we're also supposed to perceive that this is all really
this is
place.
It's all No. It's all really happening. It's it's not in her head. It's not, you know. But as a viewer, what you are watching has very little resemblance to how people would communicate with each other, you know, how these various scenarios would go down.
Sure.
If she were to put herself not just in the situations with people who would not perhaps harm her, but the people who might harm her don't quite often. And so you are wondering, okay, well, so she's slipping in and out of these scenarios unscathed.
Mm.
And getting the satisfaction that she wants, but it's not enough satisfaction for her. And now I'm going to stop telling you what happens in the film, because I don't want, again, to give away the ending. I like the rage of this movie.
Mm-hmm.
And once I figured out that I was in a... Again, not a metaphorical situation, but a highly symbolic one.
Mm-hmm.
I was content to watch where it was going to go. I think, how do I say this without talking about the ending? Here. The film in the early 90s, going back to, again, to the young queer you and me,
mm-hmm.
and the new queer cinema of the early 90s. When I saw The Living End, Greg Araki's film about two young queer guys who discovered that they are HIV positive and they hit the road on a murder spree, right? Just aimless revenge, rage splattered on the screen. It's a rough movie. It bears no resemblance to reality. It is Greg Araki, very, very influenced by Godard. You know, lots of wild visual stuff going on there. But you knew on one level that it was, again, a symbolic situation. Mm-hmm. You know, this is not what people would do. Is The Living End a realistic, you know, film? Is it a great film? Or was it necessary for its moment? Was that anger necessary for that moment? And I say, yes. And in the same way, I think this film, its anger is necessary for this moment. Does it provide a realistic portrayal of how you deal with the events that take place in this movie? No, not if you want to have a good life. Not if you want to, you know, nurture yourself. Because who in real life is a single-minded vengeance mission person?
Right.
Who is that? A person who, if that person is out there, that person is sort of slowly grinding themselves into dust. So this movie is a film about a woman who is a proxy for, you know, community rage. So I think it's worthwhile. It does not provide a nuanced understanding of how you live your life after things like that happen in this film happen. But that's not the point of this movie. Someone else will make that movie.
Right.
And how many films do we have in the world, in popular culture, where women confront these issues and find their way through in a way that doesn't harm themselves?
And how many of those movies are directed by women?
Exactly. So those movies are yet to come, I think. Mm-hmm. This is the tip of a wave, I think. Mm-hmm. And we're already seeing a little bit of that. But I'm this feels like the shot that's fired.
Right.
That leads a pack of something else.
Yeah, I find this movie frustrating in a lot of ways. And if we're not going to talk about the ending, then that is a lot I can't get into. But I, you know, as I've been saying, as I've reviewed this film and other podcasts, I'm all on board for what this movie is saying.
Of course.
I'm all on board for the rage part.
Right.
And as with The Living End, like, that movie meant a great deal to me as a young queer person.
Right.
In the world, dealing with how crappy the world was to queer people in various ways at that moment.
Right.
And I would not have wanted some straight film person coming along and pointing out to me all the stylistic or narrative or whatever things that make the movie not work or blah, 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 because that didn't matter to me. So I do have issues with some of the narrative and stylistic things of this movie, but I don't feel like being the guy who's talking about it when so many people, you know, women, yes, but men also,
right,
have been responding to this so strongly and that it means so much to them. Also, I know of women and men who don't like this movie
that
and have
correct.
The same issues that I do.
That is correct.
But it's gone beyond the notion of being just a movie.
Right.
So I don't feel like sort of weighing in on it on that level, because the things about it that are beyond a movie, again, I'm all for them. A thing that I had not...
He says it up here!
A thing that I had not really thought about, but that we talked about when we discussed this on Who Shot Ya,
yeah,
is that she has... That Emerald Fennell has cast in the role of the predatory men all of these people who have been like nice guys on TV.
Yeah, I love the casting.
And movies. Christopher Mintz-Plasse.
Right.
Adam Brody.
Oh my God. Christopher Mintz-Plasse's scene.
Max Greenfield, you know, people
is
like that.
So great, because I can tell you this. It's a funny joke. You'll laugh anyway. Yeah. He recommends that she read David Foster Wallace.
And David Foster Wallace.
David Foster Wallace has become, this started on Twitter.
Yeah.
He's become shorthand for, like,
kind of bro intellectualism.
The worst thing that a young literary straight boy could offer you. There goes your phone.
No, it's for some reason my phone rings in my computer. I don't know why it doesn't.
That's
weird. I don't know how to stop it.
Okay. Anyway, it's a funny bit. This is a kind of a dark comedy at first.
Yeah.
And then as she starts to unravel, and this is actually where I felt the film most deeply as a human drama. Mm-hmm. As she starts to slowly kind of, the toll is being, it's taking a toll on her.
Right.
Her actions and her desire for this revenge is taking a toll on her. And the characters that I find the most fascinating as this happens are not the scenarios where she's with the guys, but it's the scenarios where she's with her parents and with Molly Shannon, who plays the mother of the friend who was raped.
That's the one scene that feels like two human beings having a conversation.
Well, yeah, I think it's meant to take you out for a moment, because everything else has felt so stylized and strange up to this point. And then you get this moment with Molly Shannon where she's like, I need to tell you something.
Right.
And it's a thing you're not going to want to hear. You know what I mean? I had a really long conversation with a friend about the parents' house. Her parents are played by Clancy Brown and Jennifer Coolidge.
Yes.
And they live in a house that is so strange. If you're watching all the details of the scenes where they are in the home, mm-hmm. again, because I don't want to give away, you know, stuff, I don't want to talk about what I think that house means. Maybe later on down the road, we can talk about it.
All right. Because my take on the house is that it seems to have been art directed to look like the sort of bourgeois ideal of people who would have been like Clancy Brown and Jennifer Coolidge's parents.
That is correct. That's correct. And I think it's intentional because the friend that I had the conversation with said, what if the parents are stuck in that house? And now she's stuck in that house with them because she lives with them.
Mm-hmm.
What is that? What's happening in that family on a mental health level that is contributing to the stuff that you and I are not talking about plot-wise? And so, you know, what is this? What about this story is generational? Ideas and attitudes and fears and understandings of human relationships that have been passed down from the parents of Clancy Brown and Jennifer Coolidge to them, to their daughter, to the culture at large. Like, who teaches these nice guys that it's okay to do the thing that they're trying to do to her? I think a lot of visual stuff in this film is informing the narrative. And the further I get away from it, the more I like it as a package. You know, again, like I said earlier, I don't think this movie has anything to tell you about what to do in real life.
Right.
But it is a great sort of like conduit, like a lightning rod for legitimate cultural anger. So there, yeah. Okay. That is what I think about Promising Young Woman. Y'all ought to see it because it's certainly like the movie of the moment. I don't know who's seeing it. I don't know what kind of like
film Twitter's all over it, but indicative.
Twitter is
like,
not the real world. Like you know what I mean? Yes,
going right there. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, even as somebody who I do have big problems with this movie, but I think that it is a movie that leads to interesting conversations.
So, okay. You understand what I'm talking about in terms of like this movie's not meant to be plausible or realistic.
Yeah,
and you don't want it to be more like that?
I don't think it quite threads that needle. I think wants to have it both ways.
I think it does.
Well, we disagree. But yeah, see it, talk about it. I certainly want to see the second film from Emerald Fennell.
I'll tell you, we just watched the new Denzel Washington movie.
Mm-hmm.
It's about a serial killer. It comes out next week. We'll talk about it next week. But as I was watching it, I thought not only about this film, but I thought about Tenet as well. And a letter, an email that our listener Shadi sent to me about Tenet. And these three films together have got my head, you know, thinking of some stuff I want to say next week when we talk about the Denzel Washington movie and some questions that I have about what is the place of female-directed violence. Violence directed toward female characters. That's what I meant. Violence directed toward female characters in big mainstream films. So anyway, That's for next time.
Okay.
But yeah, I, you know, you can hate this movie, Promising Young Woman, or you can love it, or you can be in the middle like Alonso. but I think it's totally, it's something to see.
I see why it works for people. It doesn't work for this moment.
It's a film that you should
see. Yes. I see why it works for people. It doesn't work for me, but I do think it has a lot going for it in the zeitgeist department that it merits a look.
The zeitgeist department is on the third floor.
Bing!
you didn't recognize Jennifer Coolidge for like 30 minutes, right? Is that what you said?
At least a couple of scenes.
Yeah.
Because she's not blonde.
So this is dark brown hair, and you're like, wait, who is that?
Yeah.
Jennifer Coolidge. Okay, so what are we moving on to? One Night in Miami.
Yes. Yes. Makes a hard man humble.
Stop it. Don't do that. Because you get that song in my head, and I don't like that song.
Okay, fine.
It's like, I know it was written by, you know, the greatest songwriters, but I don't. Oh wait, it was written by
Bernie and Bjorn and Benny.
Yeah,
yeah.
I mean, unassailable.
True,
except for that song. All right, talk about One Night in Miami.
It is Regina King's feature directorial debut. Written by Kemp Powers, based on his play. He also wrote Soul, so he's having a moment.
Yep.
And it is based on quasi-historical events.
Here's what happened.
Okay.
Muhammad Ali, when he was named Cassius Clay.
Yes.
He beat Sonny Liston and became the heavyweight champion of the world.
Right.
This happened in early 1964.
Yes. In Miami.
In Miami. Jim Brown, NFL superstar.
Mm-hmm.
Friend of Cassius Clay.
Yes.
Said, let's party. Mr. Clay said, no. We're going to this motel and I need to talk to you about something. That's the scenario. Now, I do not know if Sam Cooke and Malcolm X joined them for this talk.
Mm-hmm.
But the very next day, Cassius Clay announced that he had A, converted to Islam, and B, was changing his name to Muhammad Ali.
Right.
Okay. So, we don't know what happened during that conversation. We don't know if it was just them, if the two other people were there as well. But the play takes this real-life moment and expands it into a fictional, but grounded in reality, four-person, you know, night of soul-searching.
Exactly.
Okay, continue.
So, yeah, and what King does, and obviously with the writer's assistance in bringing this from the stage to the screen, is rather than merely giving us a movie of four men in a hotel room, you know, there are... And I'll tell you, this is a thing that we got on the Boys in the Band's case for doing badly, which is throwing in prologues, throwing in epilogues,
right,
taking us outside of the room, you know, cutting to other stuff. So
the new Boys in the Band.
The new Boys in the Band, the Netflix one, yes.
Yeah.
So for a feature film debut, she is throwing in like boxing matches and musical sequences and like a lot of stuff. And it's...
not confined to the hotel, to the motel room.
Yes.
You are occasionally brought out into the world where these guys are experiencing what it means to be black and famous in the 1960s.
Exactly.
Which, you know, simultaneously great and terrible thing.
Right.
And you are given an example of it the moment the film starts.
Yes.
Jim Brown goes to Beau Bridges' house and is not allowed in the house. He's Jim Brown.
Yeah. Well, no. First, Beau Bridges is like kissing his ass for 5 minutes, talking about how great he is and how proud they all are. And he's such a big hit, the star of the NFL, and who means so much.
Hometown guy made good.
Exactly. Blah, 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 blah. And then at one point, it's like, oh, no, I can't let you in the house. And it's like,
And then uses that word.
Uses that word.
That word.
It's like, hell. Okay.
It's the one and only time you hear that word in the film.
Interesting.
But you're given very specific examples exactly. of what life is like for these guys.
Yeah. So yeah, the crux of the film is the four of them in this motel talking about the fact that Cassius Clay is committing himself to the Nation of Islam. Malcolm X, meanwhile, is on the outs with the Nation
leaving
of Islam,
Nation
is
of
leaving
Islam,
because
right.
of Elijah Muhammad. Sam Cooke is in this place where he is, very popular singer, but like Malcolm X is on his case for not being Bob Dylan and not, there's a lot of talk about sort of the responsibility of money, basically, like power and money, and what do they do to get it and how do they use it?
What do you do with your platform?
Yes. How are you changing the world and via what channels? And it's super compelling. The four central performances are so great.
Have we mentioned the actors?
I'm about to. Kingsley Benadier plays Malcolm X. I had only ever seen him in Noel, of all things.
He's British.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And the idea of anybody playing Malcolm X after Denzel Washington, that's like, actors like, nope, no thank you. He's so good in this.
Yeah.
And gets these moments, like I've never seen Malcolm X portrayed in a film in such a human way in terms of like,
you mean outside of the Spike Lee film, well, Malcolm X.
The Spike Lee film Malcolm X, he is a figure of power and he is a figure of social change, which he certainly is.
Yeah.
But you don't get a moment in that film, like in this movie, where his friends are busting his chops.
Okay, sure. I get what you're saying.
It's like how the movie 1776, for instance, takes people like Ben Franklin and John Adams, who we think of as like, faces on money, and portrays them as people who have like foibles and who have rivalries and who have, likes and dislikes, whatever.
Right.
So like this movie, Malcolm X is all the things that Malcolm X certainly was, but he's also like a guy with his friends, and his friends can, goof on him and
can make fun of him and
call him on his stuff when they think that he's, when he's overstepped.
Yes.
Eli Gorey, who is on Riverdale, plays Cassius Clay. Mm-hmm. Again, after Will Smith has played Muhammad Ali, not a role that's very easy to step into. Hell, just being Muhammad Ali, such a larger-than-life personage,
right.
such a performer.
It could become a caricature if you aren't really paying attention to, who this person was.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Aldous Hodge as Jim Brown, he's so great. He was in Hidden Figures, he was in Straight Outta Compton, he was on that show Leverage. And then Leslie...
Was he Ren? In
yes.
Straight Outta Compton? Okay,
yeah.
Yes.
And then Leslie Odom Jr. from Hamilton as Sam Cooke.
Right.
Doing his own singing.
Yeah.
This is one of those movies where, like, I'm sure the play was great, and I'm sure on stage it was, electrifying.
Right.
But, like, it's so hard to do that in a movie and kind of, either be closed in enough or be not like keeping, if you're going to open it up, keeping the open parts organic. And King, I think, does that really well here.
I am really happy to see Regina King using that Academy Award to branch out and take power and do whatever she wants to do next. I know she's been directing commercials.
And episodic TV.
Yeah. So this is just a very satisfying next step. Yeah. I'm really... now I'm stoked to see more from her.
Yeah, for sure.
Also,
this is a sidebar. It's not relevant to her directing, but she's also like the voice of the, I think, Cadillac ads now, which...
Right, I think those are ads that she directs.
Yeah, okay.
Yeah.
But it's just, you don't usually hear women do car commercials. I go back to...
Doesn't Glenn Close do them?
Oh, that's true.
She might.
You're right. She
did, I mean, I don't know if she does, but in my head, I think, oh yeah, well, of course Glenn Close does car commercials.
Maybe, but you could be right. I was thinking about that movie, that Lake Bell film, In a World, where they talk about how women don't get to narrate trailers, you know?
Right,
it's like it's very codified by gender. It's like, you know, men get trucks and women get, you know.
You do think about, like, the two kinds of car commercial voices as, you know, the voice that is the guy for the truck. Built Ram tough. Yeah. Like a rock.
Yeah.
Yeah. Sam Elliott.
Yeah.
It's Sam Elliott.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's John Hamm.
So you either want Sam Elliott to sell you a truck or you want John Hamm to sell you
a sedan.
A sedan. Yeah.
The ultimate driving experience.
So yeah, no, I get it. That makes sense. I hadn't considered that before, but I could have sworn I heard Glenn Close do it from time to time.
I
could be wrong.
There was that sketch that Nicole Payone used to do on the Big A Sketch Show where it was her doing Damages is brought to you by Cadillac. Maybe that's what you're thinking of.
That might be what I'm thinking of. Hey, there's a restoration.
Uh-huh.
4K restoration.
Okay.
Of Usman Sembene's Mandabi.
Okay.
Now, maybe those three words are things that you've never heard before. Well, Usman Sembene was like the father of African film.
Pretty much.
Senegalese filmmaker. He made an hour-long film before this one in the 60s called Black Girl.
Yes.
And this was a 90-minute, his first, like, what people would now consider a narrative feature-length film.
Mm-hmm.
It is called Mandabi. It means the money order. And it's from 1968. It is currently streaming in virtual cinemas, art house virtual cinemas. So if you go to your local art house, and it might be available to watch streaming.
Or Google Mandabi.
It is currently streaming via Film Forum in Los Angeles. It's at the Lemley, L-A-E-M-M-L-E .com. And it's based on a novel written by Usman Sembene.
Oh, okay.
He based it on his own. It's like a novella. And it's about a man who lives in Dakar. And he is poor. He hasn't had a job in about 4 years. He has two wives, seven children, and he's in need of some cash. His nephew has been working in Paris as a street sweeper and has sent him a money order for 25,000 francs, which is apparently about $100 in 1968 dollars. But that's $100 that needs to go a long way.
Sure.
Not only does he owe his sister money, he owes other people money, he owes the grocery store money. And as he tries to cash this money order, a series of unfortunate events unfolds and things go from bad to worse.
Oh boy.
And along the way, what you learn is that not only does he not have the paperwork he needs, he doesn't have the identification card that he needs, but he's got people who are very, very ready all around him to take the money, cheat him out of it, or very happily watch him try to pawn things so that they can get whatever they can get from him. It is, again, meant to be a dark comedy, but I'm watching it feeling increasing anxiety. Like
the description alone is
over the, you know, like when you're watching The Bicycle Thief, or as it is now called, Bicycle Thieves.
I was thinking about that.
This is, you know, neorealism from Senegal.
Yeah.
And he is not always a sympathetic character, the main guy. Sembene used first time actors across the board in this film, but as a character, he's not super sympathetic because he's not nice to his wives. He's kind of a jerk. And, but increasingly you see the world closing in on him and crushing him, not in proportion to his everyday sort of quotidian jerkishness.
Sure.
Like, people are jerks day in and day out. They don't have to be destroyed for it. If you watch, though, you'll notice that a lot of the people who are the worst people are not dressed in traditional Senegal clothes. They're dressed in very sharp 60s suits. They are the representatives of the government. They are the representatives of the banks. They are the representatives of bureaucracy, of French colonialism, and the way that it leaves a destroyed place in its wake. And that's ultimately the point of the film.
Right.
The restoration is beautiful. The colors have been, you know, realized again, you know, after decades of, I'm sure, prints that get faded and faded.
Right.
It is a really sharp, sophisticated story about, you know, the forces that ruin regular people's lives. And one interesting footnote I read after the fact, there's a song in the movie. One of the women in the film sings a song called Mandabi. It's a song about the money order. And you're thinking, oh, it's a song about a money order. Well, that song became actually quite popular in Senegal until authorities decided, you know what? We don't like what you're about here. You're inciting people with this song. We're not going to let you play it on the radio. So anyway, it is like, it's every Franz Kafka short story that you had to read in high school where, you know, this guy is up against
everything.
Impossible, you know, not impossible odds, but impossible situations where one person is saying, you don't have this thing, so and I'm not going to give you the money that you need because of it. You're going to have to go to this other office where you also don't have a chance of succeeding, you know, and it's just this circle of pain. It's great. It's a great film, and I heartily recommend this. It was my first time viewing it. It was new to me.
Cool.
And glad I did.
All right. Do you have a DVD pick this week?
I do not. I most certainly do not. How dare you speak to me this way?
My DVD pick a documentary from a few years ago that I thought was really powerful and is now getting a Blu-ray release from the Criterion Collection, and that would be Minding the Gap. And it is a film about three friends who are skateboarders. And
oh, I love this movie.
You kind of think you know what you're in for, but you know, they get older and they become adults. And once they become adults, suddenly the things that were important to them when they were younger become less so, and other responsibilities and issues come their way. It's a beautifully made film. It's a really insightful look at these three lives and, you know, how people grow apart and how people change. And I just think it's a beautiful, beautiful film.
Want to hear a letter?
I would.
We got some letters.
Okay.
All right. Here's one. It's about Mank. It's from Jamie. Hey guys, I wish I could have seen Mank with fresh eyes, but I had just seen Trumbo maybe a week before, and I'm wondering if it inhibited my enjoyment of the film. Which did you guys like better? Your faithful former Dairy Queen employee, Jamie.
You know, I had not really thought about putting them up against each other necessarily.
Don't think about Trumbo.
There were things I liked about Trumbo. I do often think about the fact that I always think about that scene where he confronts John Wayne over not having served in World War II, despite his whole public image of being a big flag waving patriot. And I remember Helen Mirren being very juicy as the awfulness of Hedda Hopper. You know, I don't think that Trumbo has the style of Mank necessarily. I mean, Fincher obviously is in a league of his own. But I think they're both they both have things that are good and things that are not. I'll say that.
Yeah, I don't have any opinion about Trumbo. It's been a while, and
forgotten it.
I don't remember anything about it. Like, yeah, but you know, Mank was fine.
Yeah.
Jeremy in Canada says, "Hope the end of 2020 finds you relatively unscathed and happy. For me in Canada, the virus has been relatively tame, and I haven't known anyone who was hospitalized or died. But I miss society a lot. 2021, nowhere to go but up. At the beginning of 2020, I set myself a goal. Half the films that I would watch would be directed or co-directed by women. The challenge was eye-opening. I've learned that achieving this goal is pretty much impossible if you are not consciously tracking it. Thought it was pretty good at supporting the work of female directors for the past couple of years. Only 20 to 30% of my watches were female-directed films. I probably won't continue to be as strict about this going forward. It's hard to keep track of, but it's set a good benchmark. I've gained some new favorite directors as a result of this challenge, and digging through their back catalogs has been a delight. Here is a list of female-directed films that I watched for you to knife.
Okay.
Here we go. Portrait of a Lady on Fire.
Oh, love it.
Stories We Tell, Sarah Polley.
I still need to see it. It's coming on Criterion Channel in February.
Oh, is it?
Yes.
Okay, cool.
I need to watch it.
First Cow.
Great.
Pariah from D. Reese.
Oh, beautiful.
The Body Remembers When the World Broke Open. This is from 2019. It's from Kathleen Hepburn and L. Mahia Tailfeathers. I have not seen this.
I've heard the title, but I don't know anything about it.
We need to hunt this down.
Yes.
Harlan County, USA.
Oh.
Just fantastic
intense,
documentary.
Yeah.
The Rider from Chloe Zhao.
I liked it.
I remember this conversation. Yeah. I loved it, and you
no, most
liked
people,
it.
Most people loved it.
Yeah. Desert Hearts.
Oh.
1985, Donna Deitch.
Yes.
Happy as Lazaro, 2018.
Oh,
Lazaro
so
Walker.
Great.
Yeah. That's on Netflix, you guys.
Yes.
And you should watch it.
Happy as Lazaro, Lazzaro. Really, check it out.
The Second Mother from Anna Mueller.
And yeah.
I haven't seen it.
Oh, that's the one about the sort of the housekeeper knowledge
I know.
Of the yeah. No, it's really good.
I never got around to getting to it. Thank you for all the hard work you do. Without stumbling onto Linoleum Knife by way of Pop Rocket a few years ago, my movie life would be undoubtedly less interesting, fulfilling, and queer. Here's to a better 2021. Thank you, Jeremy.
Thanks, Jeremy.
Last one here is from Julius. And this letter came, okay, this is from January. I wanted to talk a bit more about Manola Dargis, the conditions of viewership under COVID. It's something I've been thinking about for the past 2 months since COVID numbers started rising and my stress levels and coping mechanisms have increased. I noticed that I was watching more shallow films like the Hallmarky film Christmas Town, where Nicole DeBoer is a businesswoman whose dad moves to Hollyville, a cult compound where the members worship Christmas like David Koresh worshiped UFOs. But she follows upon a grotesquely greasy cultist, Patrick Muldoon, who saves her from being such a Christian. Is this a real film?
It's a real film, yeah.
Okay.
It's one of the older ones.
It's a great Hallmark remake of Silent Hill. It kind of came to a head when I was watching A Night to Remember based on a holiday movie gift exchange that we do with the Solute. I've never been able to say that word properly. Solute. S-O-L-U-T-E. I'm bad with words. For readers who don't know, A Night to Remember is the old movie about the Titanic sinking that focuses on all the action aboard the ship on that final fateful night. James Cameron would remake it as Tape 2 of his movie Titanic. That's a VHS joke right there. Remember when it came out on VHS?
Oh, yes.
It was two tapes. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But while watching A Night to Remember, I came to the realization that we have enshrined the Titanic as a massive tragedy in our collective consciousness. The Titanic is a singular note of nature overcoming man's hubris and taking a massive number of lives. In reality, it was a one-night event where 1,500 souls died, and we have it enshrined as immense. Yet, in my reality, 2,000 to 3,000 Americans were dying every day, not including any other country's death rate, and people were still fighting not just to stop lockdowns, but fighting for their right to not wear a mask in public and continue spreading this disease. How is it that we can enshrine a tragedy of 1,500 people with multiple movies, books, and TV specials? Titanic was a cottage industry for a while. But fight to escalate a tragedy that has had a daily death toll nearly double that. The cognitive dissonance distracted me from engaging in what is actually a well-constructed and sober movie. This isn't the fault of A Night to Remember, but it's what I brought to the movie.
Mm.
I found that I'm getting a little better about de-stressing, but still somewhat struggling to engage in movies without outside influences. For example, I was just wondering what COVID would have done to the delivery worker family in Ken Loach's Sorry We Missed You.
Oh, interesting question.
Yeah. As such, it's more difficult for me to justify plopping down $15 to $20 for a thoughtful movie that I can't process on the terms in which it was made. I knew that Loach's film would sustain such an invading force of COVID when the escapism... Sorry, I just screwed up that sentence. I knew that Loach's film would sustain such an invading force of COVID when the escapism of Christmastown is a click away. Anyway, it was a great discussion. I enjoyed it a lot, though I wish it was more of a two-part conversation, with this being more of a discussion around the state of the industry, and the second part being more explicitly a best-of-the-year conversation. Yeah, I was thinking about that after the episode. We talked a little bit about our favorite movies of the year, mm-hmm. but mostly it was a conversation about the year.
True. Yeah. Well, here's the thing, though. Like, Manola and Justin and Peter all ran top 10 lists.
Yeah, they did.
You can always just Google them.
And I spoke mine into being on this show the week before that episode.
Yes, you did. And mine's on the rack.
It was not a top 10 list. It was just sort of like, I like these movies.
Bad movies.
We're done.
All righty.
That's the end.
Okay.
It's time for dinner. I don't know what. Bowl of cereal. That sounds good.
Thank you all for listening. Check out our friends on the internet. Go see what Bibbs and Whitney are up to over the critically acclaimed network. Listen to the Schmoes Know. Dennis Enun with Dennis Hensley. The Comics Canon. The Sewers of Paris. All Things Cozy. Deck the Hallmark. Check out my other shows. Who Shot Ya? Breakfast All Day. And A Film and a Movie. Listen to the Big Fat Gay Podcast. Fat Guys of the Movies. Criterion Cast. And Secretly Timid. You can subscribe to this show for free at Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. We'll read it on the show. You can also leave us positive feedback in the many places that we stream, including Stitcher Radio, TheLounge.com, Spotify, Google Play, Amazon Music, CastBox, Podbean. You can follow us at LinoleumCast on Twitter, Instagram, and Facebook. Drop us a line at linoleumpodcast@gmail.com. And oh, hey, don't forget our Patreon.
Right.
At patreon.com/linoleumcast. We do lots of extra content for our subscribers, everything from daily recommendations to Linoleum Knife Presents More Linoleum Knife, where we take a deep look at one individual title, LKTV about television.
We did one of those this past month. We need to at least do another one this week.
Yes.
And I've got the movie all picked out.
Yes, you do. Yeah. Linoleum Knife and Fork, which is a show about food. Linoleum Nights, where we talk about more provocative topics. All kinds of options there.
We are provocateurs.
We are provocateurs. Agent provocateur. Patreon.com/linoleumcast. Thank you, Blue, for our theme music. Follow him on Twitter at Blutopia, BLEUTOPIA. And until next time.
Goodbye.